Salo Falava. I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific to celebrate our resilience, revival, and deep-rooted connection.
Search for Culture Compass wherever you get your podcasts to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Papongi manea, yakwe, and maloita mai pompongi ni. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm your host, Marian Kupu, here in the capital, Nuku'alofa, from the friendly islands of Tonga. Thank you for joining us. Coming up, the Pacific Islands Foreign Ministers meeting commences later today in Fiji's capital, Suva. Inga's former police commander says a gun amnesty deal is working despite a recent shootout with police.
Most of the conflicts have gone down and highways and the towns have become a bit more safer.
And imagine the sight of a 20-meter-high tower made up entirely of taro. 6 tons of taro, to be exact. Those stories and more here on Pacific Beat. I'm Marian Kupu, your host, yours in the Pacific. We go to Fiji, where the Pacific Island Forum Foreign Ministers meeting opens later today. Australia's Foreign Minister Penny Wong is in attendance. Yesterday, she announced $23 million Fijian dollars, the equivalent of close to 15 million Australian, in funding for Fiji's HIV response. And Minister Wong spoke to the media about preparation for the pre-COP meetings in October. Our Fiji correspondent, Letha Mavono, was at the press conference and join us now on the line from Suva. Letha, malolele.
Malotonga epungpungini, Marian, how are you this morning?
I'm very cold. I'm pretty sure it's more cold here in Tonga than it is there in Fiji. But yes, let's start with the pre-COP. You asked Senator Wong directly about whether Australia is struggling to get world leaders to Fiji and to Tuvalu. What did she say?
Yes, that's right. She acknowledged the question, didn't come out exactly to give us too many details, but said that they would continue, the Australian government would continue to appeal to world leaders to make their way to Fiji and Tuvalu. She reminded them that they needed to be in the Pacific to see exactly the impact that climate change has on our islands, but also on the lives and the livelihood and the economies of the region. And with the pre-COP meeting not too far away, we are waiting to hear more from the Australian government as to exactly which leaders are out their way here. She didn't push back when we asked the difficulties that Australia was having getting other world leaders to come, but she said that they will continue to encourage leaders to come to the Pacific.
Yes, I understand why world leaders want to come to Fiji, you know, with a tourist attraction, but why does it matter so much who shows up, particularly to Tuvalu?
Because Tuvalu is the entire point, Marian. You can brief a world leader on sea level rise in a conference room in Nandi or, you know, elsewhere in the world. But when you're standing on Funafuti, it's a completely different experience. And, you know, the water level and the way that it's coming into and encroaching the villages of Tuvalu, like it is elsewhere in the Pacific, it's very real when you're actually standing in Funafuti. And that's why Pacific leaders had specific wanted that segment. The people that you need to persuade at the big conference of the parties events that happen everywhere in the world. The message lands better when you're actually standing at the front lines of climate change. But there's also a practical problem. Getting to Funafuti is difficult. And so the flights, the only way to fly into Tuvalu is through Nandi. So the real question now is whether people will be able to see the message that Australia and the rest of the Pacific are trying to tell the rest of the world.
Yes, as I mentioned before, Senator Wong is there in Fiji for today's Foreign Ministers meeting. What is Estrada actually trying to get out of that meeting?
Well, the words that she said was she wanted a more powerful and a stronger Pacific, but her framing was in regionalism as a security tool. She said she wanted a stronger region, one that was able to handle the health challenges, and bearing in mind, Marion, that she was speaking while at the opening of Fiji's major new HIV headquarters. She said she wanted a Pacific that was able to also handle the economic pressure, and especially during these uncertain times in the world. But she made a point of saying that the forum brings all 18 members of the Pacific together, and that gives the region a stronger voice. But the line that was really important to listen to, I guess, is that she says that countries need to make their own choices about who they partner with and not to be coerced into that. So she never said the word China, but she really didn't have to. But she also talked about the treaty that Fiji recently signed with Australia, the Vuvalu Union, or the Ocean of Peace Alliance, which should be getting ratified in the Australian Parliament in its first sitting after in the coming weeks. And she said that the Ocean of Peace is Rambuka's idea, so that sounded very strategic as well, saying that it grew out of his vision and then it was adopted by the forum leader. So it should be interesting what she says about this treaty at the foreign ministers meeting that starts just in over an hour.
And Lisa, the HIV announcement, $23.5 million, is this new money and what is it meant to do?
It is new money, and it's 23.5 million Fijian dollars, and it sits on top of the 12 million Australian dollars already announced for the HIV response. So that's roughly 19 to 20 million Fijian in earlier funding. She said it goes to prevention, to training, to workplace support, to community outreach, and to essential health supplies. She was blunt about the scale of the problem, describing Fiji as having the fastest growing HIV outbreak in the world. And she was equally blunt that money alone won't fix it. She said no single leader, no single program would deal with this, that it needs a whole of community response. And she made a point of noting that the faith leaders and traditional leaders who were present at the presentation were also part of the solution. And this part stood out for me because she deliberately tied Fiji's HIV outbreak to the drug trade and to transnational crime. Here's Senator Penny Wong.
And our support recognises that this is a health challenge, but it is also a security challenge. Alongside our health partnership, we're also working together to combat transnational crime, illicit drug trafficking, which is contributing to this challenge across the region.
And that was Australia's Foreign Minister Penny Wong, and I was chatting with our reporter in Fiji, Luthe Movono. Here in Tonga, the parliament resumed this week proceeding with the unseating of two ministers' cabinet. This comes as Lord Speaker announced the receipt of the Supreme Court decision in the election petition regarding these two ministers from last November's election. I have here now the Tonga Broadcasting Commission acting editor, Popua Aho, with the news wrap. Popua, can you tell us more about the unseating of this week?
Yes, thank you, Marianne. So Parliament resumed this week, and the main thing on the agenda was the unseating of these two MPs for Tonga Tapu 2 and Niwa 17 after their election results were voided in court due to breach of electoral law, one for overspending, which was the Minister for Infrastructure and Tourism, and the former Finance Minister was found guilty for indirect bribery for giving away slices of fish, as I'm sure we already reported earlier. But following the court proceedings, the next step was the unseating in Parliament, which took place this week. There was a little bit of debate because before the official or formal unseating in Parliament, the former finance minister had already submitted his resignation from the House. And so there was a little bit of debate regarding the legal effect of this member resigning after an election petition had already been determined, but before being formally unseated in Parliament, as there is a law that prevents members who have been declared, whose results in the elections had been declared void, from serving as members of Parliament for 5 years. So there was a question whether they would still be able to return to Parliament following their resigning rather than unseating, but the Minister for Justice clarified that there was no distinction and a person who has been declared void for their election remains disqualified from serving as a member of Parliament regardless of whether they resigned before being formally unseated.
Yes, Papua, but now we're looking forward to by-election and possibility a new cabinet for Prime Minister Fafanua. But going to New Zealand, to Australia, we have Her Royal Highness Princess Pilole Vutuita visiting Australia at an invitation from the Australian government.
Yes, this visit is part of Australia's Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade program that is aimed at showcasing Queensland tourism industry, as Her Royal Highness is visiting Brisbane and Cairns in Queensland this week. So there were many opportunities there for Tongan tourism, who are also part of Her Royal Highness's delegation, where they will get to observe and learn from the industry in Queensland and possibly adopt some practices that may prove useful here in Tonga. So Her Royal Highness met with Queensland Governor Dr. Jeanette Young, as well as visits to popular tourist destinations in Queensland while she was in Queensland this week.
Thank you, Papua. And lastly, besides the tourists coming to swim with the whales, maritime pilots from across the Pacific are also here in Tonga for the third Pacific Maritime Pilots Conference and Workshop. Can you please tell us what else are they doing here besides the conference?
So this Pacific Maritime Pilots Conference and Workshop is taking place just before the 48th Pacific Maritime Transport Alliance Conference, which is a major maritime conference in the Pacific, and Tonga Ports Authority is hosting this week. So Australian Marine Pilot and former Director of Port Phillip's Sea Pilots, Damien Lachlan, spoke with Radio Tonga News earlier, saying the program this week was designed to equip Pacific pilots with high standards of knowledge and the expertise required to carry out their responsibilities safely and effectively in the ports where they serve.
The pilots enable them to bring in bigger ships and to protect the infrastructure of the island nations, which helps the people provide supply of their products and their goods. It's easy when you think about a marine pilot, an individual like Captain Motu from Tonga here, who steps on board a ship as an individual. But we try to encourage thinking of the pilot as part of a system. And what that means is that when a pilot works with the tugboats that push the ship around, and he works with the port authorities, and he gets access to weather information, he gets access to line information for running lines to make the ships fast, it all forms part of a really big system. And we encourage communication within that system because you get better and safer outcomes by encouraging that communication.
One of the main challenges faced by maritime or port authorities in the Pacific is infrastructure, which a senior pilot from the Cook Islands, John Jesse, had this to say regarding this issue.
In the Cook Islands, we are quite unique and very vital when we're operating in our small port. So we get a ship vessel comes in at 118, but the entrance is only 50 metres wide. So once we make the approach, there's no room for error. And when we commit, we have to commit to put the vessel. If anything doesn't come out right, things do go wrong, then there's no chance of trying to pull the ship back. So it's quite vital, different to other ports. You've got a bigger port like here in Tonga. And the maneuverability here in Tonga is very simple compared to our one in the Cook Islands. So it's very important. I know there are some pilots here, this is their first time coming to this conference. This is my third time, and I was part of the Pacific pilot training group that we instigated this conference to happen to all different, wherever the PMJ goes, the pilot organization will follow them, and then for us to introduce our purpose to all the CEOs in different countries as well.
That was John Jesse, a senior pilot from the Cook Islands, who is joining the workshop here in Tonga as one of the representatives from the Pacific Islands. Meanwhile, Damien Lachlan emphasized that this is one of the importance of this conference, as they look into ways to solve the challenges that Pacific pilots are facing.
The biggest challenges across the Pacific generally involve infrastructure. So the island nations have challenges getting the funds needed to build new infrastructure. So the pilots have to work with the infrastructure that they have. So we help to solve that by training them with modern technological solutions like the portable pilot units, which is a computer that the pilots can use to help them navigate the vessels in safer. And we help to train them up with these modern techniques that can try and protect the infrastructure, because protecting the infrastructure is really what a pilot's job is, managing the risk for the port. Part of what we're trying to teach the pilots and the techniques we're trying to teach the pilots is really, it's partly education and partly, so partly knowledge-based, but it's also skills-based. So we provide knowledge of the equipment, we provide knowledge of the systems that run these navigation tools that we're showcasing, and we're backed by our sponsors who are here to help show the equipment that's available and try and work out solutions for the pilots in the region. And we also provide skills-based training. So we have a workshop day on our final day where we practically demonstrate the items that we've talked about the theory of in the first 2 days.
So that was Damien Lachlan, a senior Australian Marine pilot and former director of Port Phillip Sea Pilots, who was leading the workshop here in Tonga.
And that was Popua Aho, the acting editor for Tonga Broadcasting Commission, with the events here in Tonga. But now, a former police commander for Inga in Papua New Guinea, Fred Yagasa, is defending his people as law-abiding citizens in the face of continuing violence in the province. His comments follow a recent ambush by gunmen on the current police commander, Stephen Harris, and his team. Chief Superintendent Harris is one of two Australians working with the PNG Police Department. A gun amnesty and buyback scheme for illegal weapons has been enforced in Inga since March, with the aim of curbing inter-tribal fighting. And Mr. Yagasa says despite the recent incident, there have been positive signs.
Inga law and order has improved. Since I've gone there, all the tribal conflicts, we managed to stop all the tribal fighting. There was a big conflict in what we call middle around Batman, the area gathered. We managed to handle that through a peace agreement. So most of the conflicts have gone down, and the highways and the towns have become a little bit more safer. After that, there is a Surrender Afghan Amnesty program run by the man under the Ministry of Police, Honorable Station, very on foot right now. And many tribes have actually surrounded their para. Some of them, many of them are factory-made, very hard power. People want peace. Now the fed up with the tribal conflict. What happened to the PPC and his one or two other policemen as he was driving down from Dama Wolda back to Wabi is something that we have seen it in the paper, but we don't know much about the story as yet, so I can't say anything about it.
If the story is true about what happened to the PPC and some of his officers, and you're saying that the law and order situation is controlled, so why do you think that's still happening?
Yes, control meaning many conflicts. We have tribal fights all over the province. You had managed to put a stop to many of those conflicts. Now they're going into peace negotiation, peace settlement, and of course, peace building. That's what certainly across the province. That does not mean to say that it's all paradise as yet. It could be an isolated issue. Some people wanted a vehicle, should they have a vehicle, or they know they should be here. I'm not sure.
Is there a problem with people owning guns in the province?
Yes, it has been a problem. It's still a problem. Therefore, not only healing a problem, but of course, a top here. Gun is what people eat to advance their criminal activities or intent.
former police commander in PNG's Inga province, Fred Yakasa, and he was talking to Caroline Tiriman. The island of Maiwo has been hosting Vanuatu's National Agriculture Expo. One striking image from the expo that's gone viral across social media is the site of a 20-meter-high tower made up of entirely of taro, 4,000 taro plants to be exact. The monument weighs over 6 tons. Chief Rasaure told our reporter Lily Rose Wellwell that the tower pays homage to a local legend about how taro became Maiwo's first crop.
And I come up to remember my history of how taro came to our island. So I designed a tower. According to the story that the moon and the sun are talking to help people in Maiwo, they only have one kind of food before, but now they decide to give them some more variety of food. The moon told the sun that I will go down closer to them. If you go down, you will burn the whole island. He will give us energy. I will give them agriculture. And at the time, the moon moved closer. As the moon watches what is happening with the human in the ground, feel sorry for them. When the moon cried, the tears fall onto the ground, and they started growing different types of food, different types of crops. The first taro was born here in Maiwo, and also the first banana, we have them here too, and the taro was called Wara. At the time, the farmers are not human. The farmers are birds. And if you see on the tower, we have sun, moon, and the bird. The birds are natural farmers. So I built a tower to reflect the story, what we hear from the old people. I built a tower to go up towards the moon and the sun.
So this is a massive structure, taller than most buildings in the village. How long did it take to build it, and how many hands went into it?
8 of us to build the tower. It took us 2 weeks and a half to finish the tower. I study all the woods that we use. You see, when they are green, they are light. But when it's dry, they are lighter but stronger. So the wood that I use is the special wood that I think it's good for engineering the tower. The long wood that goes up, it's a roots from the banyan tree. I estimate the tower to be stronger to hold up 10 tons of taro. So actually we've only received 6 tons of taro, and it still stands there.
So what does the, how many taros are there, and what type of variety is it there?
We have 175 varieties of taro. Actually, we have 200, but some of them we lost them. We missed them. We didn't plant them anymore.
What will you do with the taros after the expo?
We've already distributed them among the provinces. The below one, close to the ground, belongs to the Panama province, and then the second step is for Torba province and Sanma province. I divided them into 6 provinces plus 2 municipal, Luganville and Port Pirie.
So you spoke earlier about how the skills and the significance in custom about how you went about building this structure. Is this a skill passed down to generations, and are younger people learning it today?
That skill is passed down to a younger generation, but not publicly. But this only we negotiate to put it out publicly. I use only the special people that we got rank to do that. So we display that what we've been hidden in our Nakamal for a long time. So actually, because you asked, so I now agree to report that yes, all these skills passes down from before, from our old people, but it only passed through people who are ranked to use. So we have those ideas to how to build that. So while building it, nobody got accident, nobody got killed. Yeah, we have to successfully finish that.
Chief Rasaure speaking there to Lily Rose Wellwell about story behind Maiwo's massive taro tower. Pacific Beat. Tonga police say they're investigating allegations of arranged marriages in China, along with claims passports were confiscated and money paid to brokers. The ABC first revealed the allegation last month. Now, for the first time, one Tongan woman has come up publicly saying she was lured to China with promises of money and a better life. 21-year-old Hunika Toa says she traveled to China for marriage and the promise of financial security for her family in Tonga. Huni says everything from her passport and visa to her flights was arranged for her. Before leaving Tonga, Huni was sent a photograph of a man she was expected to marry. But when she arrived in China, she says she was surprised by the man she met.
I think the photo was taken when he was about 16 years old. But when I arrived in China, he looked completely different from the photo. When I met him, he was an elderly man.
Huni was told women traveling to China would spend time getting to know their new husbands before marriage. She says instead, she signed documents she didn't fully understand. It was only afterwards she realized she was legally married.
We were simply told to sign. Neither of us knew that by signing those papers, we were getting married.
Not long after, Huni says she wanted to return to Tonga because she missed her young son. It was when she told her family that things changed. According to Huni, her husband became angry and contacted his family, who in turn contact the women who had arranged her trip. She says she was questioned about already having a child, despite believing they already knew. Huni says she was told to divorce her husband and marry another Chinese man. But when she refused, Huni says she was told her family would first have to repay money spent on her travel and marriage.
Hi, Auntie Talamaika.
She told me my family had to repay the money. She then told me another option was for me to marry a different Chinese man. The money from that marriage would be used to repay the first husband and his family.
Huni continued to live with her husband's family while she waited for the divorce to be finalized. She says they stopped providing food, forcing her to rely on another Tongan woman living in China, who would regularly send her money to buy food and later offered her a safe place to stay. Huni says her husband's family refused to return her passport, even after the divorce was finalized. She says they wanted money spent on her travel and marriage to be paid back. It was at this point Huni says she went to the Chinese police and they intervened.
The police handed my passport back to me. The police told them, that is not her responsibility. If you believe someone owes you money, you need to deal with Auntie Julie.
Huni says police then took her to the station where a Tongan woman living in China, Tapenisa Mahe, collected her and took her in. She says it was her aunt in the United States who helped her return back to Tonga.
I hope they will learn from my experience. They should ask questions, check the facts, and make sure they fully understand what they are getting into. No matter how much money is being offered overseas, it is not worth what I experienced.
No place like Hasim.
Huni's account follows the ABC's earlier investigation into allegation that young Tongan women were recruited to travel to China for arranged marriages. Tonga police say the investigation is continuing. Those accused deny any wrongdoing, while the Chinese embassy has previously described the matter as a transnational marriage dispute and says there is no evidence to verify human trafficking.
That was Huni Ka Toa, and she is the first to come out publicly and reveal her identity as someone who has been lured into these arranged marriages in China.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
The 2026 OFC Champions League kicks off in Fiji on Sunday with the first two matches featuring the host nation Rewa against Galaxy from Vanuatu and Lai City from PNG will play Cook Islands Tupapa Mararenga. Title holders Auckland City begin their champion against Central Coast from the Solomon Islands on Monday, looking to make it 5 championship in a row and 13 overall. So the New Zealand team were likely to start as favourite to win yet again, but OFC media operation manager Matt Brown says there will be a different feel about the Champions League this year because of the influence of the OFC Pro League.
There are 34 players, I believe, from the OFC Pro League squads who are competing in this competition. Rewa with the most, 11. So they feel they have, you know, a great chance to go a long way and maybe deliver a very first OFC Champions League title for Fiji. And Central Coast from the Solomon Islands, they have 9. Greeted them last night at the airport and a few familiar faces from the Solomon Kings FC squad. So they will also fancy themselves, I think. AS Venus from Tahiti, 8 players from the Champions League from Tahiti United. So they also will be thinking they could have a good run at this. They've got a very young team though. And Auckland City FC, they've got 6. So some established stars like Michael Den Haier coming back from Auckland FC, the champions of the Pro League. Christian Gray, who was at South Island United, another strong defender coming back to Auckland City ranks. So, you know, the defending champions will certainly be tough to topple too.
Which takes me to the next point then. One thing that Auckland City have been noted for is not just winning the OFC Champions League on a large number of occasions, but also, of course, famously, they made the semi-finals of the World Club Championship. But that avenue is closed to them now since the birth of the Pro League, closed to them and anybody else in the Champions League.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, I know that's disappointing for Auckland City FC. They had a, you know, a credible record, really, of representing Oceania in that competition. 2014, they went to the FIFA Intercontinental Cup and made the semi-finals. It was an amazing run for the bunch of amateurs from Central Auckland to achieve that. And of course, you know, they represented OFC at the inaugural FIFA Club World Cup, where they, you know, got a draw against Boca Juniors. Christian Gray hitting that goal, which could have created headlines around the world after heavy defeats by Benfica and Bayern Munich, you know. So it certainly has given that club a lot on the world stage. They have a huge social media following around the world. But they're an amateur club. And the point I would make too is, while they, yes, they're disappointed to not have that, you know, that pathway into those sort of competitions, they did look at the club licensing. They did consider a bid for a OFC Pro League spot, but then ultimately decided, for whatever reasons, not to proceed. So they knew that that pathway would eventually end. But here they are in Fiji, and I know they're pretty keen to maintain their amazing record in this competition. But, you know, I think the gap will be pretty close this time. Going to be some very competitive teams that they'll be playing.
You mentioned the OFC Pro League players involved in this, and you pointed out Rewa in particular from Fiji, 11 Pro League players in their lineup. Could this be the year that we see just the third time that a team not from New Zealand wins the Champions League?
Look, I think there's an opportunity. The thing that I was always really interested in, and with watching the Pro League right throughout the season, because there's a month-long stand-down for Pro League players before they can go back to amateur clubs, or in some cases have signed with different professional clubs in the region. A lot of the Pacific Island players have gone back to clubs in their own countries. And so what I was really interested, Richard, in seeing is what impact they would have, what influence they would have on their amateur teammates. Let's face it, the whole mentality of playing amateur football is often, you know, rock up to training twice a week, then go back to whatever you did, and then play a game on Saturday. It's very different to being in a professional environment where you have, yes, extra resource, but also that emphasis on your training, your diet, all those sorts of things. So that is what is going to intrigue me, and see what influence some of these players have been able to have on the amateur teammates. In other words, raising the standards by being surrounded by professional players. So I do personally think that the clubs that have got the Pro League players in their four will have a bit of an advantage, but there's also a little bit of a unknown about, for example, the Lay City side. They don't have any Pro League players, but they won the Papua New Guinea domestic league, you know, beating Hikari. Hikari were the team that was given the license for the Pro League, so they're going to be strong. I think there's a lot of unknowns in the competition. The Vanuatu side, Galaxy, coached by Bartram Suri, renowned Solomon Islander, I suspect they will be pretty tough to beat too. They actually played some friendlies against Vanuatu United during the Pro League and were very competitive from my understanding. So I think it could be a really interesting competition. It's not just going to be favourites necessarily win the matches.
Media Operation Manager Matt Brown talking to Richard Eward. In Papua New Guinea, a major conservation agreement rather has been signed by the leaders of 41 villages in Papua New Guinea's Torricelli Mountains. The conservation deed will see a restriction on logging and mining over 1,225,000 kilometers square of rainforest. The Tenkile Conservation Alliance organized an agreement after nearly three decades of speaking to communities in the area. Finau Funua spoke to Jim Thomas, director for the Tenkele Conservation Alliance.
We've established what's called a conservation deed, which is a legally binding document in which 41 villages that hold 266 clan members, who are the people here in PNG who decide what happens to the land, they've all signed an agreement, a conservation deed, that states no logging, no mining, and no people coming out without free, prior, informed consent and agreement by the villages themselves. So, yeah, we're essentially protecting about 135,000 hectares of tropical rainforest here in Sundown province of Papua New Guinea.
What you describe, mining and logging and so forth, could you describe the threats?
The main threat here is logging. There is mining leases and explorations around the area, but the Torricelli Mountains and Sundown province, the main threat to biodiversity and tropical rainforest here is industrial logging. So a lot of that isn't done properly. And, of course, we've been trying to lock up these areas for 24 years and there's still logging companies trying to come in certain places of it. So, you know, that's a concern. So we need to protect that with the landowners, with the consent of these clan leaders, so that, you know, we can look at legal action down the track. Now that we have a conservation deed, we can do that.
The discussions you've had with clan leaders and the communities about conservation, could you describe that, how you and your group were able to educate and raise awareness about conservation and getting these communities to come up with an agreement, with a deed to protect this forest area?
Yeah, sure. So establishing this conservation deed has taken more than 20 years of work in terms of talking to the villagers, letting them know how important their animals and rainforest is to not just themselves and Papua New Guinea, but to the whole world. You know, rainforests are responsible for producing so much oxygen in the world. They're critical to the survival of the planet. And tying in their cultural practices with that of our knowledge of university and coupling that in education courses so that people felt empowered from the knowledge that they've learnt over the generations through their culture and their languages. So doing that really helped give confidence to the people and pride, which then helped them appreciate their natural resources more and wanting to protect them and do things sustainably. And in line, we've been able to help the people with community development projects, as well as doing some research as well, in addition to what Tim Flannery and a few others have done previously. So it's been a slow process building the capacity and the trust and the rapport with the people, and that takes years to establish. And I think after about the first 3 or 4 years, that's when we started to think that we were getting a bit of traction and were part of the communities and people wanted us to stay here. So long haul in terms of getting the communication and people really wanting to keep their culture and preserve it, the language as well, and, of course, the biodiversity and the very special rainforest here in the Torricellis and Sundown province, which perhaps holds as much as 4% of the world's biodiversity. You know, really is a rich area, just beautiful, you know.
4% of the world's biodiversity.
Correct.
That's quite incredible.
It is. So if our predictions are right and we want more partnerships with universities to come in and look at, you know, such hypotheses that we hold, but, up to 4% of the world's biodiversity within 0.003% of the world's land area. We are hoping to expand the area in terms of the new villages coming in, and we are now got our eyes set to try and conserve the Bawani mountain ranges to the west as well. But you're looking at species, you know, so many bird species. So Papua New Guinea has, I think, 802 species of birds. And here in the Torricellis, we believe there's over 400. We know there's over about 385 have been recorded on eBird from all of the the bird watchers out there who come in here occasionally. We want to encourage that and open the door for tourism so that people can see what's here and see it face to face as opposed to just on YouTube and on the Nat Geo channel. And, you know, that's another way of sustaining the area, keeping the loggers out and the people happy with projects and money in their pockets as well, is what we do, plus ecotourism, which we're starting to build now.
Jim Thomas, the director for the Tinkile Conservation Alliance, speaking there to Whina Whanua. Hundreds in Central Australia have delivered a letter to the front gates of a secret defence facility calling for the land it's built on to be returned to traditional owners. Located in Alice Springs, Pine Cab is a joint Australian-US spy facility that gathers intelligence from a network of civilian satellites around the globe. Among the protesters was Australia Green Senator David Shoebridge, who says the facility is among the reasons preventing Australia from joining Pacific allies in signing the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons.
Pine Gap is this prominent, notionally joint US-Australian defence facility, secret spy base. It's right in the middle of Australia, just near Alice Springs. It's been operating since the early 60s, and I was invited out there, together with many other people, by the local traditional owners, the Arende people, who are the traditional owners of that part of the land. And they asked for people to converge on Pine Gap and make it clear that this US defence facility has never had the consent of First Nations owners. They never agreed to providing their land to the US military, and they want their land back. They want access to their cultural sites, and they don't want any part of what the Pine Gap does in the world. And so it was a pretty extraordinary event. We had the Hayes family, who are the traditional owners. We walked to the gates of the base and delivered a letter demanding their land back. And you know, there are things you do as a politician, but that walking with these traditional owners up, you know, to the gates of this very, you know, brutal US defense facility in the middle of the country, you know, that was a pretty significant moment. And it harkens back to other protests that have been happening on the site since the late 70s, early 80s.
Yes, well, there has been reports in recent years that Pine Gap plays a, while small, but also critical role in a lot of sort of targeting operations. And this obviously all follows a Pacific delegation, which actually went to Parliament House recently to try and urge the Australian government to sign up to the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. In your opinion, should Australia sign that treaty?
Australia should 100% sign the treaty to prohibit nuclear weapons. Every nuclear weapon is a war crime waiting to happen, an obscene war crime at a scale you can't imagine waiting to happen. And what's remarkable about that treaty is there's now more than 100 countries that have signed it. But the treaty started in Australia with peace advocates and a group called ICAN. And they conceived of the treaty in Australia, and then they worked in partnership with our Pacific neighbours and friends, and people thought this treaty could never come into effect. But it's now into effect with more than 100 countries that have signed it. Yet the Australian government refuses to sign it. And the key reason they refuse to sign it is because of our alliance with the United States, where we continue to permit the US to bring nuclear weapons into Australia, to have nuclear weapons on B-52s, you know, at our Air Force bases, to bring nuclear weapons on their naval assets that they bring into our ports. And obviously Australia is the Labor government, and, you know, other parties like the Coalition and One Nation want to double down on that alliance with the United States right now. And, you know, at a time when they are clearly a very reckless partner to have in the world. So, you know, when traditional owners were walking up to demand the shutting down of Pine Gap, you know, that is very consistent with what we're hearing from Pacific leaders who want the Pacific and our neighbourhood to be a region of peace.
Australia Green Senator David Shoebridge speaking there with Carl Evans. Time to look back at our main stories today. The Pacific Island Foreign Ministers meeting commences today in Fiji. Australia's Foreign Minister, Penny Wong, is in attendance where she announced funding to support Fiji's effort in addressing a HIV crisis.
Well, she talked about wanting a stronger region, one that's able to handle health challenges, which was relevant because she was at the opening of the new HIV headquarters.
My name is Marianne Kupu. I was your host today and hope everything goes well with you. Tuning in to Pacific Beat, I'm hosting here from Nukualofa, Tonga, and we'll be hosting again next Friday. You'll find our top stories on also on our website. Just type in Pacific Beat and Radio Australia in your search engine and also via the ABC Pacific Facebook. There you can listen Pacific Beat Live or catch up on the full Pacific Beat programs. Malo Alpito, Tua Ofatu, Marianne Kupu, signing out.